Shields, the material to be used for a biography of Arthur Evans. Bill, when did you first meet my dad?
When he came into Princeton to organize the miners that were being killed like flies. Because the mine operators were gutting the mines and they weren't putting in enough timber to make it safe.
There had been quite a few deaths in Princeton mines?
Many. It was a common occurrence. The miners had an unwritten law that they brought with them from all parts of the world, mostly from Great Britain, I believe, that when a man was killed in the mine, all work stopped for that day, and the whistle blew. And whenever that whistle would blow, the women would all come out in the back porch and be wringing their hands and their aprons and wondering, was my John or my Bill? They knew somebody was killed.
Miners lived with death and hard work all of their lives, particularly in those days. What do you remember about safety conditions in mines?
Well, that statement I just made, I think, explains the conditions. I never was in a mine. But the conditions were bad, and there was a tremendous disaster there. I don't know how many men was killed, but it was a mass funeral, and the only hall in town big enough to hold the people that came to that funeral was the Catholic hall. And it was the first time, I guess, in history that the Catholics and the Protestants conducted a joint funeral.
Also, with these unsafe conditions, I believe that they had been forced, the miners that is, to take a 10% wage cut as well.
Well, I believe that's correct, and I'm quite sure it is. But I was not being in the mine, I wouldn't know. When I first met your dad, was when he came into Princeton to organize the miners, to help them organize in order to combat these conditions. He brought two young fellows with him, the name of Pete Lowe and Pat Driscoll. And they were distributing leaflets and selling the workers' paper on the streets because the police attacked them and arrested them and charged them with the aliens causing trouble and arrested them and sent them off to Ocala for 3 months. But that didn't stop them. The 3 months was over, they come back and they went right at the same task all over again. And this went on three different times. It was 9 months in between the time that Evans first came to Chilliwack. And I got mad enough to become interested and take part in it.
These are the provincial police. We had a provincial police at that time who do, I suppose, what the RCMP do now. Is that right?
That's right.
It wasn't the Chilliwack, I don't think.
Huh?
It wasn't the Chilliwack, was it?
Did I say Chilliwack?
Yeah, I think we all met Princeton. And you first heard Dad talking at one of these meetings, Bill?
Yeah, Slim Evans called a mass meeting and appealed for the citizens of the Princeton area for their support in view of this arresting of his helpers and intimidation of his abilities to try and organize these people to protect themselves. And it was at that meeting that Slim pointed out the terrible conditions in the mine and how that these people were working only three shifts a week, and they were actually, because they were still on the payroll of the mining operators and companies, they were not eligible for relief, and the people on relief were getting more money to feed their families than the miners were. If conditions were that bad.
Was there any force or any kind of thing done to stop Dad from doing this organizing? I'm thinking of perhaps not renting halls or being at meetings by the police?
Yes, the authorities done every trick in the book to intimidate the miners and the public at large. They organized the Vigilantes Committee and a Ku Klux Klan, and they intimidated every hall owner in that town, with the exception of one man, and I don't know his name, that lived in Tulamine, that owned a vacant lot right in the heart of town, and he gave me written permission to use that lot for a public meeting anytime I wanted. And that's the lot that I got arrested on and taken to jail in order to, when they were trying to stop the On to Ottawa track. That's a year or two after I first met Slim.
Was my father in those early times in Princeton also trying to organize the relief camp workers?
Yes. He was in there many times, and he always got a mass packed hall anytime Slim called a meeting. He had a big turnout, and then the police would be at those meetings for the sole purpose of intimidation, trying to, just their very presence would intimidate some of the more timid ones that wouldn't dare get up on their feet and speak in the meeting or ask questions because the police were there. And then Slim on the platform pointed them out. He says, just because those two yellow legs are standing at the back, don't let that stop you from voicing your opinions and then speaking your piece. He says, you take their shirt off and they got a yellow streak down their back three times as wide.
Why do you think he had this distrust or perhaps dislike of the provincial police? Can you think of any reasons?
Well, the very fact that they were condoning all this intimidation and were part of it. And he knew it, and so did we.
How about on the picket lines? What role did the provincial police take in Princeton?
Well, the big picket line where the police came to the picket line, they secretly shipped in two car loads of mounted police and their horses. And the first day of the picket line, there was only a handful of provincial police there, and then the inspector, I forget what his name was, addressed the miners and the pickets and pointed out that all they were there for was to maintain law and order, and they were not taking part one way or the other in this struggle. But they were just there, and they wanted one big happy family, and all they were there for was to keep law and order.
Had there been any trouble by the miners on the picket line, or were they walking a peaceful picket line?
There had been absolutely no trouble whatsoever. And then by the chief of police making that statement, he disarmed all of us, including the miners and the citizens that were on that picket line, believing that they were honest and sincere when they made that statement. But the next morning, at 5 o'clock, the same policeman come out there, backed up with two carloads of mounted police on their horses, and instead of them talking, he just called the picket lines to order. He says, I order this picket line to disperse now, and he waved his hand forward, and then mounted police just rode into them and beat them down and clubbed them like as though they were cattle.
Were there just miners on that picket line?
No, it was half the citizens of Princeton was on that picket line.
Women and children as well?
Yes.
And they were beaten?
I don't just remember. I know one guy, he was beaten so bad that he cracked his skull wide open, and he put his arms up over his head to protect himself, and they broke his arms. And it was that night about after it was all, after the everybody had finally dispersed and gone home, that Slim called a meeting, and it was reported at that meeting that this one miner was pretty badly hurt, and they thought he was laying up in his cabin, and I, along with a couple of other fellows, I forget their names now, went up to the cabin to see him, and the police had already picked him up and taken him to jail, and they arrested him and charged him with obstructing the police while performing his duty. And that man was in jail, and Slim forced the authorities to get him a doctor and patch up his head and set his broken arms. But he still went to jail. I don't know for how long, whether 3 months or 6 months.
They seem to... Okay. What are some of the other recollections you have in Princeton?
Well, at that meeting that night when we heard about this guy getting his head split and his arms broke, Slim called for public support on the picket line the next morning. And that was my first actual activity in the class struggle.
This was the beginning of your trade union bit, was it, Bill?
Yeah. That was it.
Yeah.
And myself and my brother George and a friend of his but Tiny White, another little fellow by the name of Mac Young, all were batching in a log cabin about 3 miles out of Princeton, belonged to Bob Hamilton, who was a trapper. And run a trap line back 5 miles every winter. And we called this cabin the Rock House because it was built right at the face of a mountain on the face of the rock of the mountain the size of this room that we're sitting in got dislodged with the water getting down in the cracks and it freezing and wedging it and finally it come down. And it was about the size of this room and it came right through that cabin. It was a log cabin. It knocked every log out of the back wall and it rolled and it broke every floor joist to just about one more flop and it would have went out the front wall, but it stopped.
You were to get onto your first picket line the next morning?
Yes, well, my brothers, two brothers, and then a fellow by the name of Tiny White and Mac Young, five of us lived there, and we all agreed to go to the picket line the next morning in support of the miners and protest against the police brutality. And being dumb or whatever you want to call it, we went to the bush and cut ourselves 6 foot sticks about 2 to 3 inches thick and about 6 feet long. And we took them along with us to the picket line as protection. If the police was going to ride into us and ride over us, we were going to drive one into the ground and duck down so that they would have to ride into the sharp end of our stick before they could get to us. Anyway, we were arrested, and those sticks were confiscated, and Slim Evans was arrested, and those sticks was used as evidence in court, as proof that Slim was advocating force and violence.
That was the infamous Section 98.
That was under Section 98, that famous law that says you're guilty and you got to prove yourself innocent. So the only way you could do that was get two guys to swear that you weren't innocent, you weren't there, and they got two for one. So
during all of this time, there's mention of the Ku Klux Klan. I always thought this was something that the Deep South owned only to themselves. Could you tell me something about the KKK in the Princeton area, Bill?
Yes, the KKK played quite a role in that strike. The miners that were working after the strike was finally won and settled, before it was still on, these miners would get notes signed KKK, warning them that they better not have anything to do with this organization if they knew what was good for them, and statements to this effect, to the point where they even went so far as to burn the fiery cross on the point of the mountain just leading out of Princeton on the road going up to Tulameen, and on the point of the other mountain where the airport now sits. And then in the middle of the night, when them two fiery crosses were burning and all the street lights were out, it was quite an eerie sight and a scary sight. And it drove terror into the hearts of everybody that was involved. But old Slim, it didn't stop him. He called a mass meeting to point out that this was nothing but intimidation. One of the miners, John is all we knew him of, or all I knew him of at that time. And then Slim was talking to the miners that night at the meeting and mentioned these Ku Klux Klan burning their fiery crosses. John, under the question period, he got up and suggested that, well, if they're going to burn the fiery cross to intimidate us, why not us burn the Jack Union? Of course, he meant the Union Jack. So poor old John got known as Jack Union from there on out. He went to Spain and died under that name, as far as I know.
Also, my father in Princeton charged 8 people, 2 of them provincial police, with kidnapping. He apparently was taken out of a home, put on a train, and told to get out of town. Could you agree with that statement, Bill?
Yeah, he was definitely taken out of town, but he wasn't arrested in a home. He was living in, I just don't know where he was living, because he had to move every night, a different bed, in order to keep from getting killed by these mad maniacs. And then the pressure was so great on him that he went for a walk out in the bush, and the police arrested him in the bush, and he was carrying a stick as a sort of a walking stick, and they brought that into court and used it as evidence that he was a violent man, and used this stick as proof that he was dangerous.
The strike was won in Princeton, and later on, Father had to go to trial in Vernon under Section 98. I know that you were a witness at that trial. Would you please tell me what you remember of the trial?
Well, the fact that the trial was held in Vernon was for the sole purpose to keep as many witnesses, as many people from taking part in it as possibly could, because nobody had the money to go over there. But Slim was able, and through the Canadian Labor Defense League and his lawyer, Mr.
Grant
was able to get a special bus and transportation for all his witnesses. And I was one of them. And we rode to Vernon to Slim's trial in style, because it was, up until that time, I was riding the rods, a cushion ride through the Okanagan and up to Vernon was quite a pleasure in itself at that time, never mind going to the court case. But anyway, Canadian Labor Defense League and the Workers' Paper organized a workers' jury headed by Bob Leavis, who's dead now, and Bill Purvis, Bob Kerr, and